Apple lawsuit, when you dig into it and you go into the Reddit threads like I did, which was real fun to see that crew get into the mix. I mean, this is bad. Turns out you've been DuckDuckGo, Rick, though. You're not living.
I have not tried the duck.
Yeah, no, me either. But it sounded funny in the moment.
It's the model, stupid. Like, our model needs to get better. We need to get better for developers, or else Anthropic is going to eat our lunch. Gemini and Microsoft are going to eat our lunch on distribution. Ooh, welcome to the Watson Weekly. I'm your host, Rick Watson.
Hey, hey, it's Jess Lisetsky.
We're here and we have a great show today. Our three stories up. Shopify pulling the plug on vapes. Can't use them anymore on your store. Second up, the great private equity traffic jam. Where are the exits? We try to find them. And third, our mega story this week is OpenAI. They had the worst Thursday, and it seems like the last couple of weeks have been a big debacle for them between lawsuits, exits, and a dead browser. We're gonna unpack that.
Sam's got 99 problems. And fun ain't one.
No, fun isn't one, but you know what is fun? Our newsletter is a lot of fun. We have a newsletter at watsonweekly.com. You can check it out there. Put in your email address. Get great news every week where we unpack what's going on today. How do you make yourself smarter and run your business just a little bit better?
And have fun along the way.
Yeah. And have fun, especially with this yellow haze we have going on in New York City.
That's right.
It's a little rough.
Mask up, friends.
Exactly. Our first story this week is the eviction notice from Shopify. They're pulling the plug on vapes. In case you haven't heard this, Shopify sent every merchant selling vapes a notice to strip those products from your website by July 8th. Miss a date, you lose the products. Ignore it, you lose your whole store.
Both.
This came after a coalition of states, cities, California, Illinois, Arizona leaned on Shopify over the illegal sales of vapes. Obviously, they're the store provider, just like a sort of like a DNS provider. They're a point of leverage for these states to put pressure on and kids getting easy access to vapes against the rules of those states. Of course, the pressure is about illegal vapes. However, Shopify's response is to ban them everywhere, not for every state. So that's really the story. And so when we think about what's happened here, Shopify is a software platform, runs your e-commerce business. In the middle of that is obviously of any e-commerce platform is a payment processor decision. Shopify clearly comes with a default payments processor. ShopPay is at the center of all of it. That's backed by Stripe. Payment is a linchpin of those things. MasterCard, Visa have been getting their own pressure from the federal government for several years on various platforms. I know you've even seen this. You've been at eBay, Jess.
Oh, yeah.
You've seen some of this history. How have you seen this play out over the years?
Yeah. I mean, this is following a trend of, you know, what it's like tobacco hall firearms that have always been under fire, and vapes, probably a little bit of an offshoot of that. So if you look back in the history, eBay lists firearms. They then ban firearms in 99. There's gun parts that eBay bans in 2007. And then like PayPal comes in the mix, where you've got like PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, cut off WikiLeaks. So there's all this like change that happens. When you fast forward to what's gone on in the vape industry, in 2020 and 2021, PayPal purged vape sellers and Congress extended the PACT Act to vaping, and USPS even stopped shipping it. So it's been under fire for several years now. Yeah. It's interesting that Shopify takes this position, and it's almost like we don't even want any of it. Like exit stage right, this is just not our jam, and why even deal with it? So like, there's not even, I guess the money's not even enough for them to feel like comfortable taking on the risk.
Yeah, it's such a small, I mean, obviously, if it's your business, it's a huge deal. But if you're like at a huge global scale, this is like a very tiny percentage of Shopify revenue. Shopify determined like there are times where they have taken big stands for entrepreneurs against like intellectual property, people stealing those things, against the state attorneys generals at times, where Shopify makes a stand for all entrepreneurs. It goes to lobbying and things like this. This is not one of those times.
Yeah.
I think this is more Shopify reading the tea leaves, reading the writing on the wall. In 2016, 2018, the FDA classified vapes as tobacco. And I think that really is sort of like set in motion a long series of events that eventually this is going to happen. What's the point of Shopify turning back the time? Now, if you're a merchant in the audience, it's a little bit different thing. These aren't illegal to sell in every state. If this is in your state, you need to GTFO. Like, yeah. you at this point, hopefully have found another platform that doesn't make such stands. And Shopify probably doesn't care that they lost you because they're just trying to stay on the right side of the law.
Exactly. And, you know, they don't want to deal with the back and forth of like these things getting shut down, pulled up. They don't want to deal. Ultimately, also, once things happen like this, the lawsuits follow. And it's such a tough category. I mean, you think about like parents getting involved, the whole Juul lawsuit that happened several years ago and like how that whole thing imploded. And I just think Shopify wants none of it. Like they have no time, no space. And we talked about last week, like the Shopify policy police, like creeping in. And, you know, again, maybe this is the COO saying like, let's put on our adult pants here and just go do this.
Let's just get ahead of it. This is going to happen eventually.
Yeah.
And I think, on the other side, if you're talking about merchants for a second, it definitely in retail, in e-commerce, especially online, the lines are different depending on what you're talking about. And the there are two or three big fault lines. They're advertising, they're payments, and they're shipping. And so advertising, if you're in the CBD industry, you know how difficult it is to understand like what's on Meta's rules this week, what's not on Meta's rules this week. Like if you're a merchant in this space and want to have control over your own destiny, it seems like vapes are moving from kind of this gray area to a red area. And if you're in this red area, it means you like, you need to take control over your own destiny, probably get off of SaaS platforms that depend on a payment processor, either build your own software or leverage software that you pay for once and you don't have to license it over and over. That would be my advice to you.
Or maybe diversify your category.
Yes. Change your category. If there's, is there something else you could sell? That might also be a good idea.
As a mom of teens, you know.
Yeah. Best of luck to you.
Keep them off the streets.
Tax compliance is one of those things that sounds manageable until it isn't. You add a new channel, you expand to a new state, you start shipping internationally. Suddenly, the complexity catches up with you. Tariffs, duties, VAT, jurisdiction rules vary everywhere. And a customer just got hit with an unexpected charge when their order arrived. That's not just a compliance problem. It's a brand experience issue. Avalara is how I solve this for clients. I've been recommending them for years. When we help clients select new providers, Avalara is always the call. Works right inside Shopify, BigCommerce, WooCommerce, wherever your brand lives. Accurate tax at checkout, visibility into tariffs and duties before the order ships, and fewer surprises for your customers. If you're scaling into new channels or new markets, don't let the tax layer slow you down. Check out what Avalara has built specifically for growing brands at avalara.watsonweekly.com.
To bring us into our next story, Rick, if you've not been following, there has been a drought in the PE exit sector for somewhere between 9 to 10 years. PitchBook had their Nostradamus-like forecast of what was going to happen this year. And we're at the mid-year point. So we do what we do. We like to do a little look back and have a little check-in on the scorecard and see what's going down. So I just want to kind of flash, though, where we're at to set the scene. And if we look at this PE activity deal by quarter from like 2021 to 2026, you can see it has been a bumpy road, almost down to a significant drop off and decline, where one of their predictions was big leverage deals were going to grow to 25% or a quarter of all PE activity. Instead, they slipped to 21% at the end of 2025. They're down to 19% as of May of this year. It's rough out there. We've got tariffs. We've got scare over AI. We have a conflict in Iran. And people are feeling a little shifty, right? Not comfortable necessarily exiting. The other dynamic that we're seeing is fundraising is really shoring up into a few hands. In the first 5 months of the year, the 10 largest funds pulled in 48% of all the money raised. And for the first time funds, they're starting to dry up. 18 closed so far. So it just feels a little rough o'clock out there, Rick.
Yeah. I mean, in the U.S., 13-something thousand businesses are backed by private equity. And at the current selling pace, the punchline is that this is an 11-year backlog.
Yes.
Now, traditionally, PE has been more of a 3 to 7 year time horizon. For companies older than 5 years, about of those 13,000 that I mentioned, about 27% are 7 years or older. Now that means that mama don't want this stuff anymore.
No,
time to go get up out of the house.
That's
and
right.
So what do you do in this situation? You basically have the seller side who owns the asset. They don't know how much this is worth. The buyer side obviously has the luxury of waiting it out because they know what private equity needs to do. The longer you can wait, if you aren't clear that this asset is going to grow better in your stewardship, you're not going to buy it.
Exactly. And PE has a formula, right? Like you said, it's typically 3 to 5 years. They get in, they tweak the asset. Most of that's done through cost savings,
right.
Lots of different
debt,
ways to get there.
A lot of debt, reducing cost.
A lot of debt piled on, reduce cost, repackage, and hand it over to the next guy.
Lipstick.
Sometimes is it also a PE firm that's also got to then say, cool, there's more we can get out, cost savings, exit, restructure, repackage, and do the whole song and dance all over again. And part of what I wonder, Rick, you know, yes, we've had challenges in the business. We had the COVID bump, and then it's created all this lumpiness, which makes you hard to look at comps. You have the industry changing, you have AI coming in, but is part of the issue the PE playbook, which is, you know, cost savings at the expense of growth, which, you know, really hurts innovation, hurts companies like wanting to take a risk because it's got to be a sure bet. So is part of this a little bit manufactured by the formula as much as it is the market dynamics?
Yeah, I think we have a couple of things going on. Number one is we still have the COVID overhang going up. It hasn't been, remember that C word?
We haven't
been so long from COVID that if most things are over 7 years old, then that's 2019 and we're in 2026. And so a lot of these companies staffed up during that time. Mm-hmm. And if now they're on the way down, similar to the PE chart, that doesn't create a good story for your sale.
Yeah.
And so I think that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two is the AI hype and everything that's going on. Most of companies 7 years ago, AI wasn't the message, it was something else. And so as a result, the number of companies in that 13,000 PE backed software assets that are truly AI companies, probably quite small.
So small. And a lot of those are like, you know, they're swimming in VC money, right? It's not necessarily, I think some of the PE firms are trying to get in and they're doing these joint venture type deals with OpenAI or with Anthropic, like we've talked about. But like you said, you know, if you look at even those companies in 2020 that were, you know, in the PE portfolio for the first time, it was a pretty record year for buying. Only 18% of those have been cashed out. So it is kind of speaking to that lumpiness. And so now kind of where is the money going? Because there's lots of dollars that people want to invest. Is it investable and where do they invest it, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, right now, most of the money, as everyone knows, is going into AI. But I think that seems to be concentrated in a few winners. And so I think going forward, the thing to watch about this story is, does that start to unlock in the second half of the year? What do we do with these software assets? Do they just sort of like, at some point, the asset values have to be marked down to become palatable to buyers? Or if the AI hype dies down, I think that's another factor that I would be looking at.
Yeah.
Because if AI goes between sort of the haves and the have-nots, if only like Anthropic and Google and whatever, a few companies are going to be the winners in this AI revolution and everyone else, then the PE firms are actually going to be like, okay, we have regular software companies. You want to buy those?
Yes.
I think that is another thing that could happen. So
yeah, what about the like just general market? So will rate cuts help? Do you think if things normalize in this ever-changing geopolitical climate, are people kind of going to feel more comfortable exiting or buying companies and we get the deal flow moving again?
Yeah, I think until you have, I won't say a bottom, but until you know what these non-AI companies are worth,
Yeah.
And I do believe the AI bubble has to burst at least slightly for a lot of these deals to get moving again.
Yeah, for sure. So. It'll definitely be a space to watch and see what goes down.
And our final story this week is OpenAI's worst Thursday. Lawsuits, exits, and a dead browser. Just to catch you up, OpenAI has had a bad run of a couple of weeks, y'all. First of all, let's start out with OpenAI and Apple. OpenAI is said to be stealing trade secrets with like former employees, hiring managers asking former Apple employees lots of details based on the trade secrets that they learned. A former employee still had access to a file drive that someone else told them, like, how do you get the best materials from it? Meanwhile, OpenAI, I don't know if you guys have heard, it's going to go public later this year, confidentially, and they're trying to develop a new hardware angle, and they're not making any money, so they're still having to raise a whole bunch of money. So all these things are combined together saying, like, is that revenue stream going to work? On the same day, the number two executive, Fiji Sima, who's admitted that she has had health problems in the last few weeks. Unfortunately, she was formerly the CEO of Instacart. She did quite well there, formerly at Facebook, helped build a lot of their ad business. Now had a huge opportunity at OpenAI. And she's like, I can't continue to make my health a second priority. She has, you know, unfortunately, like a rare condition. And that has forced Greg Brockman, who's sort of like Sam's partner in the business, running the business, to sort of step up and do that more. Finally, if OpenAI didn't have enough problems, the head of safety systems, Johannes Heidecke, was up and resigned. Like, we're not going to have safe research anymore? We're not sure.
We don't know. And Rick, I got one more for you. There's kind of a fourth shoe that dropped. On July 9th, OpenAI announced ChatGPT Atlas is being shut down just a year after it launched. So Sam shedding some more businesses because he's got too many toys in his sandbox.
If you recall, OpenAI developing a new browser, I mean, they've only had it a year, like less than a year.
Yeah.
And it seems to follow the same pattern for Sora. They come up with these ideas. The tech press and media go bananas over it because like, oh, now they don't have to be beholden to Chrome and Microsoft. They're going to have their own distribution. This is the key to the salvation. Back it up, reverse it. This is not going to happen. The reality is, I'm using Chrome. I have 80 tabs open. Why do I open another browser?
I don't.
I mean, make any sense.
You're not using DuckDuckGo, Rick, though. You're not living. I'm just saying.
I have not tried the duck.
Yeah, no, me either. But it sounded funny in the moment. So, yeah. And then also, Sam has more legal woes. 42 state attorney general opened an investigation back in mid-June, if you remember, into potential user harm. Plus, there's a whole separate Florida lawsuit naming Sam directly. So it just feels like the news is not good and it keeps getting worse.
On the positive side, ChatGPT just did release a new model, ChatGPT 5.6. The press around it is very good. The benchmarks are very good. You know, it's supposed to be like better than Opus from a performance point of view, but a third of the cost. And so it feels to me like one of the things that OpenAI is doing is trying to get back to, it's the model, stupid. Like, our model needs to get better. We need to get better for developers, or else Anthropic is going to eat our lunch. Gemini and Microsoft are going to eat our lunch on distribution. Like, we need to have a lane. And the lane, the foundation of really any lane, is the strength of that model.
Yeah, it is interesting too, because we talked about Anthropic carving out their lane being enterprise, the Gemini lane being already in kind of enveloped in your ecosystem. And it would feel like OpenAI could say, well, we're going to get the consumer lane, but it just doesn't seem like the money is there, if you will. So is that why you feel like they've got to chase one or the other? Because consumer businesses are hard, you know, the cost of acquisition, and then constantly battling kind of maybe all the distribution that you get with like a Gemini or something else, is like that kind of why they got to come back at this a different way.
Yeah. I mean, look, if Google and Apple weren't interested or weren't good at it, I think you would be in a different spot. And if Anthropic wasn't good at enterprise, you would be in a different spot. And so what you have is like Google already has all the distribution, like 80 something percent of the smartphones in the world, maybe 90 is Google. Apple has the rest of them. Apple's paying Google for its model now on the iPhone. Yeah. Anthropic released Claude Code in the last year and has really kind of taken over that lane. Meanwhile, OpenAI was distracted from a year ago projects before Anthropic really made it big on Sora, on Atlas, Checkout that didn't work. Can we talk about Checkout again? Now they're talking about ads. We didn't even talk about ads, like the disaster situation that is coming there. Meanwhile, users don't want to be interrupted by ads, especially in a direct chat, just for the record.
My favorite one was Joe's LinkedIn post where he's like he's looking for an Avis like car, and then like a Hertz ad comes up. It's really the best. It's exactly what Anthropic said, you know, in their Super Bowl shade would happen, is like coming to fruition.
It's coming. And I think they have a big problem here. The story here is just like OpenAI has just really had a bad run of news. They're trying to change the narrative because of their new model. And I think they're really needed to go back to basics. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is like simpler, better needs to be the message, not like we're going to be multi-trillion dollars based on what they're not profitable. Who's going to be paying them the money in the long term? It's got to be these big corporations.
It does. But like you talk about them going public, and when the news is hitting this hard in a market where investors get squirrely, is this the smartest time? Like, do they need to clean house a little bit and get their you know, ducks in a row to make sure that they've got a good story to sell? I mean, the Apple lawsuit, when you dig into it and you go into the Reddit threads like I did, which was real fun to see that crew get into the mix. I mean, this is bad. They really were telling them exactly how to fish for those trade secrets, which, you know, they had a partnership at one point. And so now you've got this lawsuit, you have all these other lawsuits piling up. I mean, are investors going to just turn a blind eye and say, oh, but it's like AI and we're going to shake it all out?
Yeah, I do think initially that is what is exactly going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think over time, over the long term in the market, over a number of years, you know, Warren Buffett said it best that in the short term, the stock market is kind of like, it's public sentiment, you know, it's like hype. Over the long term, it's more of a weighing machine. Like, do we weigh, like, is this company worth more than the other? Why is it its profits, its growth? It's those things. So growth is the key. I mean, if OpenAI doesn't grow, like it could be unprofitable and growing the fastest company that's ever been minted for a little while.
I mean, Amazon honestly, ran that play.
Exactly. Amazon ran that play, and then they started, you know, with logistics and marketplace and then ads. And so they're going to do all those things eventually too, but it needs to come, and it needs to come. And I think why the pressure is on there now, as opposed to Amazon, which didn't see it until like 10 years in, is that the pace of the AI revolution has been so fast. It's been less than 3 years just to get to 50% consumer adoption of generative AI. And I've talked about this on stage as well.
Yeah.
Everyone's feeling whiplash from this. And so I think that's, what does OpenAI need to do? I think, frankly, the number one problem that OpenAI has is a governance problem. It's, we went through this whole thing where Sam was out of the company and back in the company. And the list of ex-OpenAI founders that are now founders of multi-billion dollar startups is quite long.
Yeah.
And so I think from Mira Murati, from Dario and his sister, there's just so many ex-OpenAI founders that are all over the place. They can't keep talent. And so they almost need to sort of like rebuild, reconstitute the management team and understand like, this is the primary business we're going to end. We're going to run at it.
Can they do that with Sam at the helm, right? Sam is a liability, in my opinion, because Sam's not good at staying in the lane. Sam's not good at eliminating the distractions and keeping focus, because that's not the world he grew up in, right? Yeah. He grew up in a world of
Y Combinator.
Yeah, exactly. Like following that playbook, if you put your eggs in lots of baskets because you want to have a few pop. And that's how he's treating OpenAI is, well, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this, and spread ourselves thin across all these different things because one of them's going to hit. And when you're in this AI race, you don't have that level of like focus, fortitude, commitment to a strategy. Who's the adult in the room that's like going to rein him back in?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, you're competing against Apple, you're competing against Google, you're competing against, you know, even Anthropic. These people either have more money than God on one side, or they showed a playbook for how to penetrate into enterprise and disrupt these industries at OpenAI. Yeah. Although they commercialized the technology and I think they got a lot of initial consumer interest, are they going to $10 and $20 subscription their way to success? All signs point to no from our magic eight ball here.
It sure does. It sure does.
So thanks so much for joining us this week. If you want to follow all of this news, you could also check us out on WatsonWeekly.com. In the meantime, stay classy, be bold, and see you next time.
Have a good one.